She had a history minor. She received a master's from Brigham Young University in American history and architectural history, a minor there. She received a PhD from the University of Utah, and her PhD dissertation was entitled Protect the Children, Protect the Boys and Girls, Child Welfare Work in Utah, 1888 to 1920. She's had a vast amount of teaching experience. She was a teaching assistant at BYU, a teaching fellow. She was a research fellow and an instructor of history from 1981 to the present time at the Salt Lake City campus of BYU. She's taught at Salt Lake Community College and is now an assistant professor at BYU. Her classes include history, historical research methodology, and many and subjects involving American family and community history. She's published. She's written a book on Trevor Southey, or I guess it was an article in BYU Today. Dennis Smith, Man and His Flying Machines, BYU Today, The Cloning of Mormon Architecture in Dialogue. She's published Hide and Seek, Children on the Underground in the Utah Historical Quarterly. Many, many publications. Franklin Spencer Spalding, an Episcopal Observer of Mormonism in the Historical Magazine of the Protestant Episcopal Church. She co-authored that article with John Filoteau. John Hafen and the Art Missionaries, Journal of Mormon History. Mary Teasdale, Pioneer Artist in Utah Historical Quarterly. Changed Faces, The Church's Official Attitude Toward Polygamy, published in Sunstone this year. That was on the period 1890 to 1988. And The Women of Fundamentalism, Short Creek, 1953, and Dialogue this spring. Martha also has unpublished papers that are upcoming. One on CCMI, The People's Story, be published this fall by Deseret Book. A Work Weary Child, Child Labor in Utah, 1890 to 1920, in the Utah Historical Quarterly. An article on Joseph Musser, Religious Dissenter, be published in Mormon History. And, well, let's see, that's going to be done by the University of Illinois Press. Marty has had much experience in other volunteer capacities. She's a development officer of the Utah Endowment for the Humanities for a year, May 89 to 90. She's a researcher with Cooper Roberts Architects. Editorial board of the Journal of Mormon History, 1986 to the present. Program chair for the Mormon History Association in Hawaii. She is the chair for the board of directors of Sunstone. Council member of Utah Women in History, Utah Women in History Organization. She's also done other community service. She's been a docent for the Utah Symphony. She's been a volunteer at KUED. And last but not least, she's been a PTA board member from 1983 to this present time. And I'm sure that's because she's the mother of six children. And if you're not impressed or intimidated now, there's something wrong. Gary. Alan Roberts, who will be responding to Martha's paper, is an architect. He is the co-principal in Cooper Roberts. Alan has specialized in the preservation and restoration of historic buildings, including many historic churches and tabernacles in Utah. He's currently working on the restoration of Cove Fort down in the center of the state. Alan has served on many boards and committees, such as Pioneer Trails, the Utah Endowment for the Humanities. And he was telling me so many things on the phone the other day, I don't think I got them all down. He was the co-editor and co-publisher for Sunstone from 1978 to 1980 and was an associate editor for Dialogue for 5 years. He's currently on the Board of Trustees for Signature Books. He's published frequently himself and was co-author of Salamander, the Mark Hoffman book. And I think we'll turn the time over to Martha now. She'll be speaking for about 35 minutes, and Alan will respond, and hopefully there'll be time for you to ask some questions.
Want
10 years ago, at a conference staged by BYU's Humanities Department called A Mormon Mosaic, I presented my first paper. The paper was called The Cloning of Mormon Architecture. I remember standing before that group truly believing that what I had to say would change the way things were, that my words so filled with passion and high expectations would sway opinion, that the church would somehow alter its building program because I cared so intensely. So this is an anniversary of sorts for me. I do, however, present my paper today, a decade later, knowing that despite my passion or my clever words, that nothing will change, that my voice will not be heard, and even if it is, it will not be taken seriously. So instead, this is a personal reflection on Mormon architecture, an exercise, if you will, to express that I do still care, and I assume that because you're here, you care too. Architecture is the one art most closely connected to function. Here, ideas are made more accessible, given permanence and durability. Architecture is the embodiment of idea and belief. Modern artist and social critic Ben Shahn commented on the critical connection between form and belief. Form is, according to Shahn, the visible shape of all man's growth. It is the living picture of his tribe at its most primitive and of his civilization at its most sophisticated state. Form is the many faces of the legend, bardic, epic, sculptural, musical, pictorial, architectural. It is the infinite images of religion. It is the expression and the remnant of self. Form is the shape of content. Moreover, content in the view of art critic Panofsky in his book, Meaning in the Visual Arts, is, quote, that which a work betrays but does not parade. It is the basic attitude of a nation, a period, a class, a religious persuasion, all this qualified by one personality and condensed into one work. Forms expressive of the basic age of an age, that basic attitude of an age, arise in many ways. Some shadow nature reflecting a reverence for the earth's power, an arc of lightning, the undulation of ocean waves, rolling hills or craggy mountain peaks, or simply the quiet horizontality of the landscape. They reflect the elemental order of the universe. Just as often, we invent our own symbols to help us interpret the meaning of our existence. We seem to be compelled to embody ideas in physical and tangible form, and are able to comprehend a concept more easily if we can see it, or touch it, or hold it. It is as if ideas or beliefs will more likely endure if they have concrete form. Our human compulsion to interpret the meaning of life through symbols endows forms or images with heightened meaning. Religious art and architecture have throughout time centered on this tension between form, content, and symbol. The voluptuous fertility figure or the paintings on the walls of the caves of prehistoric men and women are potent records of how our ancestors understood their lives and the symbols they used to appease their gods. As was true in prehistoric times, the interplay between religion and art continues. Therefore, LDS meeting houses, and in particular Mormon steeples, can legitimately be used as symbolic expression of the psychological condition of the modern-day church. David, would you like to? The metaphor of the house of God is frequently used by the Mormons in describing their churches. This is a gross simplification, for these buildings are actually multi-use centers significant as houses of worship, administrative centers, community centers of social life, and finally, as houses of God. The steeples of these buildings serve as the symbolic embodiment of these functions and have over time expressed the hierarchy of the ways the structures have been used. The notion of a church as a gathering place of the faithful and the literal house of God has its roots in Old Testament theology. The Old Testament story of Jacob's dream typified the process through which man moved from a belief in the Spirit of God, that the Spirit of God was literally embodied in the stone, to a symbolic depiction of the presence of God. For some religions, the building itself is a symbol of God. For others, the place, the location, is significant in terms of a miraculous event in the lives of the people. A sacred building may exist as a stage for a ritual, or it might simply be a house of prayer. Regardless, the church is ideally a place where human beings can feel the Spirit of God. In the house of God, we pursue what philosopher William James called a sense of reality, a feeling of objective presence, a perception of what we may call something there. The location or delineation of sacred spaces and buildings tells us what is sacred for a people and where it is believed the metaphysical and spiritual power lies. It is here, then, that we must look for what Duchamp describes as the starting point of the concrete. Whatever the functions of these buildings, they are testimonies to the sense of awe that people can feel. They may not tell us all we want to know about God, but they reveal much about the people who built them. Because we are most familiar with Western architecture, and because it is so clearly reflected in early Mormon buildings, the example of the Gothic serves best to illustrate this point. The verticality of the Gothic symbolized the tendency to reach into the spiritual sphere, into the heavens, to understand God. Gothic architecture was truly God-centered. Rodin, the French Impressionist sculptor, poetically characterized the verticality of the Gothic cathedral by saying, "The cathedral is the scaffolding of heaven. It gathers itself for flight, it rises, then stops the first time to meet on the balustrade of the first tier, then the construction resumes its skyward flight. It stops at the limit of human powers." The hopes of the beyond found expression in the increasing height of the Gothic cathedral, which seemed to set the laws of gravity at defiance. The most obvious vertical element in ecclesiastical architecture has always been the tower. Originally, towers housed bells to call people to worship and to spread news both joyful and sad. In times of war, medieval men used towers for defense, as refuge in times of danger. Towers stood as marking posts for travelers, occasionally served as apartments for priests who could conveniently say night offices without descending to the church below. Architecturally, the tower was the culmination of English Gothic achievement. One or more lofty, well-proportioned towers improved the appearance of a church, and eventually spires surmounted most towers. The revolution in church design, which marked the closing years of the 17th century, was due mainly to the work of Sir Christopher Wren, whose London churches, rising from the ashes of the Great Fire of 1666, created a new spatial and decorative concept of the High Renaissance style designed for Protestant worship and preaching. 52 churches were rebuilt under his direction. The earliest Mormon steeples were the indirect descendants of the Wren tradition as transported to New England during the 18th century and repeated ad nauseum in revival architecture of the 19th century. Steeples of 19th century Mormon buildings are the reminder of what Rodin called the gathering for flight. It is the last, however diffused, remnant of the flight upward, of the yearning to reach the heavens, even as the winding staircase of the Tower of Babel, the symbol of the bridge between heaven and earth. Mormon churches exhibit four basic types. First of all, no steeple at all. Secondly, a fully integrated or more substantial steeple. And third, a category I call separate but not often equal. And fourth, the afterthought, which there are two different types, a diminutive steeple placed on top of a design conceived without any thought of steeple form. And secondly, steeple as logo. Could you focus it, David? Thank you. There has always been a tradition in Mormon architecture of building buildings with no steeples at all. The small vernacular structures of the colonization period could easily be mistaken as schoolhouses or public buildings. There is nothing in terms of form or function, or form or symbol that distinguishes their religious function. And now, this building is located in Indianola, and it was built in 1916, but I don't want you to think about these. I want you to think about these buildings in a progression that varied according to location. This was usually the first type of church building that would be built. These small, primarily one-room structures were like the homes in the isolated areas of Mormon territory, usually built of locally produced adobe brick, log, or rough-hewn frame studding. The choice of material depended entirely on the availability of materials, the climate that varied so dramatically from north to south, technology, and the ethnicity of the particular group. Church buildings erected during the first wave of settlement were simple, plain in form and ornamentation, and reflected a determined community effort to create a place of congregation in the truest sense. The earliest churches were houses of worship, but also the scene of virtually all public gatherings. This is Greenwich, Utah. This week I've been reading a wonderful book called The Whisper of the River by Farrell Sams, and I just couldn't resist reading to you a description of the little church building in his community that seems so much like this one. The building stood in a grove of red oak and hickory nut trees, and the yard around it was hoed free of weeds and then swept clean with dogwood brooms. Its windows, tall and narrow, were filled with squares of handmade glass. The irregularity of each clear pane gave a slight prism to reflected light and produced a mirrored mosaic that was mismatched and undulating. The steeple had no ornamental frills, but was proportioned well to the size of the building, and it housed an ancient iron bell that compensated in clanging volume for its lack of timbre and tone. It was a one-room building, but should anyone think it crude or Spartan, let it quickly be known that this was the house of the living God. As soon as the scattered community of settlers had cleared their lands and built their homes, it was fashioned of offerings from its members. Great oaken sills from virgin forests, not freeboard sawed from the hearts of tall and straight pines. It was erected by the strain and sweat of the farmers and their sons who had felled the forests. Their hands were sure, their hearts were pure, and they built the church as a place of worship. It stood there forever after in witness that the prayer of their hands was good. There were some people who thought themselves indifferent to that church, but they all wanted it there. It gave a feeling of security, and it guaranteed succession. Even the most outspoken cynic would have been uncomfortable and filled with foreboding had it vanished. It was needed right there where it was. The church was hope and assurance. It was challenge. It was judgment. It was also comfort and benediction. The area would have been desolate indeed without it. As communities stabilized, became more stratified and diversified in terms of population, services, and resources, the people built new church buildings, bedecked with steeples or added steeples to previously existing structures. Where earlier buildings most likely had crude roofs, sawmills provided lumber to create a more finished look. The warm red brick of this vernacular structure is complemented by the white wood trim of the roof cornice and window moldings, which are more elaborate and headed by segmental brick arches. The wood bell tower is topped by a shingled wood pyramid. Its open lines contradict the sturdy feeling of the church itself. This building could easily pass for a schoolhouse. Again, the Meadow Utah church building conforms to the classical style. The round-headed windows and cornice lines stretch to a more formal and careful rendering of what is still basically a vernacular structure. The octagonal wooden tower has louvered round-headed windows and an octagonal steeple with moderately pitched slopes rising to a peak. The Society Hill Ward building was the first Mormon church constructed by the Mormon Church in South Carolina, a building built in 1907 for a branch that had existed since 1898. Its rectangular plan and plain facade and wall surfaces reflect the financial constraints of the church in the mission field. The steeple was added to the original structure several years after its original construction. This building is still in use and has been the scene of mob violence ever since 1935. This is the first of three slides that I'm going to show you of buildings that are built on the town square of Parowan, Utah. The classical detailing of the Glendale, Utah Ward House, Knapp Stake, reflects the careful regard for symmetry, order, and formality. The octagonal steeple form is reflective of the cupolas so common throughout New England. This is the Holden Ward, built in 1884. This simple wooden steeple again mirrors its New England antecedents. A balustrade separates the lower square base from the moderately pitched spire. Now, this next group is the category of fully integrated towers or more substantial towers. Although the Bountiful Tabernacle, which was built between 1857 and 63, exhibits the same classical elements as the previous few examples, the steeple itself explodes with creative energy and blatantly disregards the formality and orderly spirit of the classical revival style. Its complex series of stages do not diminish in size as they move toward the sky, but stay basically the same. Each stage is complicated by moldings and woodwork more reminiscent of the Victorian than classical detailing. The multi-spired upper level sits on a platform like a fancy wedding cake presented on a tray. The Freedom Chapel, built in 1913, shows a fully integrated steeple form. Because the building is symmetrical, the steeple is the focal point of the facade and the most basic vertical element in the design of the building. This bold square tower stretches 2 1/2 stories, ending in a tent roof. The window on the second story level above the round arch opening for the entrance to the building is the same as the windows along the side of the building. The tower cannot in any way be understood separate from the structure itself. Before lightning struck the bell tower of the Hatch Ward Chapel, which was built in 1909, the bell was sounded to announce the time of all gatherings. Perhaps the most curious early Mormon church building, the Logan Sixth Ward Tower, was a replica of the Salt Lake Temple. The building itself was built in a style that combined elements of Gothic Revival and New England church architecture, most notably its symmetry and the dentils and other careful detailing of the cornice lines. The tower steeple form of the Salt Lake 21st Ward, built in 1907, is again fully integrated into the design of the building. The main entrance to the building is located in the lower level, round-headed windows on the second story, an interesting round window with star molding on the second and 1/2 appear on the brick portion of the tower. Another example of the same type of steeple form with a more carefully rendered Gothic Revival tower is the Salt Lake 18th Ward, built in 1907. And that's another view of that. The third ward building in Rexburg, Idaho, is again a tower form that is fully integrated into the building design, but here this steeple is alive with action and energy. It is divided into seven different levels, not necessarily identifying stories of the building. And I would consider this tower totally eclectic. I don't know how you would. Ah, it's not even there. And it is a very interesting tower. Oh, and another church bit the dust, right? Okay. The heavy rusticated brick of the first level and round arch reflect the Elizabethan Tudor Gothic, while the mansard roof of the next leads the eye to the lighter Palladian windows of the third level, and on and on and on. The square brick tower of the Logan Tabernacle is topped by an elaborately detailed squarish steeple. I don't know how you describe that kind of a steeple. Curious wood ornamentation distinguished this example. The different levels of the Spring City tower more logically ascend to the pinnacle at the top. I really like this building. And I'll just run through these very quickly. The Salt Lake 16th Ward, built in 1893. The Paris, Idaho Tabernacle, 1883. Randolph, Utah. The double towers of the Nebo Stake Tabernacle flank a curvilinear parapet facade of this Mission Revival style building. The flaring tower roofs are covered with red tiles. And I think that placement of the tower of the Granite Stake Tabernacle, built in 1883 at the corner of the building, was an interesting variation on the central symmetrical facade theme. Despite this change, the overall feeling from some directions is still symmetrical. Two more. The Salt Lake 19th and the Wellsville Tabernacle. Now, this is the second of the three buildings on this town square in Parowan. During the 1920s, the church built numerous, really quite wonderful, Wrightian buildings reminiscent of Frank Lloyd Wright's Unity Temple in Oak Park, Illinois, characterized by massiveness, boldness, a sculptural look, and subtle basic proportions. Nevertheless, many Mormons felt uncomfortable with what they perceived as unchurch-like, awkward forms foreign to the Mormon architectural tradition. Perhaps this was due to the prominent lack of steeples. I apologize for how dark this slide is, but this is the third of the buildings on this town square, and I wanted you to see it. By the 1930s, the essential functional patterns of LDS worship were established that would dictate ward building design for the next 50 years. The most significant change was that future church buildings integrated all functions in one ward building. Churches designed by Don Carlos Young, the Colonel's twins, embodied this concept of integrated design. The emphasis of these buildings was on function. Steeples were again a conspicuously absent element in what were otherwise basically conservative designs. In the 1940s and 1950s, repetitive plans were produced by private architects for use by the church. Ted Pope designed an estimated 250 to 300 buildings between 1949 and 1955, more than any other single architect working for the church. His designs, like that of the Sugar House Ward, which is this building, particularly his pseudo-colonial churches, were popular, functional, and inexpensive. Steeples were a popular ornamentation on Pope-designed church buildings. Because these buildings were large, multi-use structures, the steeples were less fully integrated into the overall design of the building and have a much more decorative quality. This is a Pope-designed building that is very plain, located on Redwood Road in Salt Lake City. I think it's another example of how the economics of the individual ward unit affected during this time period the kind of design that a building might take. Now, the tower steeple form in the next series of buildings becomes increasingly less important to the overall design of the building as function, what needs the building could serve, became more important than symbol. This is the Tempe Ward, built between 1930 and 33, Mar Vista in 1928. One architect described this building as having a very cheerful steeple structure. This is the Wilshire Ward, quite a grand, magnificent building, built in 1928. This is the San Fernando Ward, designed by Harold Burton, 1949. Glendale West, 1949. Reseda, 51. Santa Cruz, 1949. And this is Shoshone, Idaho, built in the 1950s. Crystal Heights, Van Nuys, Mesa, and finally the Westwood Ward. After the consolidation of the church's building program and the church building committee in 1954, all artistic and financial decisions came under the direction of a single governing agency. A decade later, in 1964, the building program was further revamped, a move that had a profound impact on church design. The new aesthetic, uniformity of design and concept, reflected the intent to unify the international church, different cultures and peoples. For saints in the international church, their ward house was a symbol, a trademark. The steeple was the symbol that the church had arrived. This is the 11th West Ward in Salt Lake. Oh, nope, that's not. I've been struck by the idea that the steeple seems to be the one element in the design of a building where the architect has the most leeway, and maybe I'm mistaken in that. But given the financial constraints usually imposed on the architect, we have steeples that are whimsical. I'll go back. I see this steeple form quite often throughout Salt Lake City with Commercial Security Bank on it, you know, in front of all kinds of different buildings. Whimsical, dramatic, ridiculous, and often look like the contact point for a space station. We have to get to our space station. This is the Narragansett Ward, and they have a running joke in their congregation that this is where they sacrificed the virgins. These steeples usually exhibit some attempt to match the spirit or design of the church building itself, but often do not. During the 1970s and 1980s, an increasing number of LDS standard plan meeting houses had detached steeples placed somewhere nearby the main structure. Many architects who worked with these plans attempted to design a steeple form that corresponded to the style, material, or shape of the main structure. Some were successful, others less so, but increasingly the steeple form was not in fact considered in the original design of the building and had no relationship to it in terms of scale, form, or scope of design. The result is that in many of these steeple or tower forms, that we get the feeling that it was an afterthought, an element added to signal church, a sort of logo, but utterly devoid of symbolic or aesthetic potency. Furthermore, many freestanding steeples, my separate but not equal group, could be eliminated altogether and not affect the design or mood of the original structure. So many of these buildings are from Holiday. It's embarrassing, right, Phyllis? I mean, do we live in the cultural cesspool of the universe? In this way, the steeple was divorced from aesthetic considerations and became a symbol devoid of ideological impact. Often this was a financial consideration. When a stake was trying to come in under budget in planning their new church building, the steeple, when measured against a higher grade of carpet in the chapel or a larger kitchen, often lost out. The three-tier light pole steeple form, so popular in the late 1980s, was the best example of this accommodation to economic constraints on design. This became the simplest, most understated, abbreviated expression of steeple to date. It, for less than $3,000, signaled church. I think that this is really an interesting way of giving the feeling of steeple, but without separating it from the building itself. And this is the Foothill Ward, which is in Salt Lake City. This is the Bennettsville, South Carolina Ward. This steeple is made of high-impact styrene plastic, which is obviously another money-saving idea. This unusual design looks more like a squished-down syringe than a steeple. Okay. This is the Duarte Ward in California, built in 1990. And it's an adaptation of the SAGE plan. And in this example, the tower cost significantly more than the three-tiered light pole would have, but all of that money spent on something that really didn't make much of a difference in terms of the look of the building. During the late 1980s, the church building department constructed a number of churches, most notably the SAGE plan, with no steeples at all. There was nothing in the form of the SAGE, or usually the materials with which it was built, that suggested church. A number of stakes opted, after realizing how much their church resembled the local grocery store or office building, to place steeples next to their previously existing structures to more clearly identify them as churches. Others, in perhaps a worst-case scenario, put steeples, usually small and diminutive, totally out of scale, on top of the building itself as an afterthought. Other SAGE chapels were built with small steeples included in the original building. Nevertheless, these, again, diminutive steeples have the same feeling of being afterthoughts rather than integrated parts of the design. Finally, the three-tiered light pole. The change in form of steeples on Mormon churches is due to more than simply changes in style. It is an expression of what the German artist Franz Marc, who died during World War I, called the profoundest center of gravity in their own age. What, then, is the center of gravity in the Mormon church as reflected in modern-day Mormon architecture, and in particular in the Mormon steeple? First, the relationship between content and form has been obscured by the preoccupation with function, which I think can be argued expresses the content of the modern-day church, the spirit of the age, if you will. In the 1980s, Mormon ecclesiastical structures became the stage for the movement of large numbers of saints through programs, not meditation on the spirit, but the satisfaction of programmatic requirements rather than an emphasis on communion with God. Second, is the steeple of a Mormon meeting house a symbol of a house of God? Is it the symbol of a God-centered place of worship? The most automatic answer is, of course, these are houses of God. This is certainly an idea that we hear from the time we are young. But this is a case where saying it is so doesn't necessarily mean that it is. Our word houses are more literally houses of community, social, and administrative life. They are occasionally courthouses, sports arenas, dance halls, craft centers, but in terms of space, material, or construction, and the general level of respect with which they are treated, they are not even in the metaphorical sense houses of God. Our architecture reflects an embrace of the earth rather than a preoccupation with the heavens. It has become man-centered. It is spatially the scene for the interaction of the community of saints rather than the interaction between man and God. The three-tiered light pole steeple does not symbolize the function of the Mormon meeting house today. It does not in any sense have symbolic potency as an identifier of a house of God. The new logo or symbol of the Mormon word house might more appropriately be the sign welcoming visitors. The spreading roof of the sage, like a huge tent, provides a striking contrast to the vertical lines of the Gothic cathedral that stretch heavenward. The form of the sage is more reminiscent of a huge warehouse, a warehouse for worship. The steeples placed next to the horizontal sweep of the roof of a sage or other contemporary standard plan churches have become so emasculated, and I've been struck by the fact that using a male pronoun for Mormon architecture is entirely appropriate, as to become totally devoid of symbolic impact at all. In secularizing the functions of the Mormon church building, which is reflected externally in the de-symbolization of the steeple, so diffusing and de-emphasizing its symbolic impact, we are losing much, we reveal much, perhaps too much, of how far we have come and how much we have lost. Thank you.
I was so impressed, if not overwhelmed, with Marty's Vita. I think we could have just stood up here and had her radiate. I was at Marty's first paper, the cloning paper, 10 years ago, and I'm glad to kind of share that anniversary. I had an instant sense of affinity in that, as I heard her give that paper, I thought, I could have written that. I think that way. And I feel a great deal the same way today. My first comment has nothing to do with architecture, but it has to do with what I'll call Marty's lament at the beginning of the paper. The idea that, quote, my voice will not be heard, no one else cares. This kind of resignation, I think, is really sad, but I understand where it's coming from. It comes from trying to stimulate reform in the church that you care about and failing to get a response. This morning I gave a paper that was also reform-oriented in that it proposed a preservation policy for the church. This may fall on deaf ears. I don't know. But I guess I'm thinking about what happens to caring and thoughtful members intent on improving the church that they belong to and care for, and they get the response of being ignored or even worse, criticized and persecuted. What happens to people like this? Where do they go? And how can a church afford to do without people like this? Well, the first proposition from Marty was that there is no such thing as accidental form. Architecture is the embodiment of idea and belief. I'd really like to believe that's true. And I think at some level, it certainly is true. I think the question for me as a practicing architect is whether the forms reflect, not whether the forms reflect the thinking, but what is the quality of that thinking. Is it high-level thinking? Is it idealistic thinking? Or is it a preoccupation with other kinds of considerations, mundane, technically fixed types of thinking? I wish I could say that architects think about all kinds of deep symbolism and other wonderful considerations. I think, frankly, that they don't. The reality is that someone hands them a computer disk or a roll of Mylar drawings with the plans already drawn. And the plan will be a standard plan based on a formula used computing, tithing, worthiness, and other things, and that's what the people will get. A general authority once said, when the prophet has spoken, the thinking is done. This is equally true of church architecture. The thinking has been done when the architecture starts his work. He may lay out a parking lot, choose colors of brick and carpet and paint, and make a couple of other cosmetic adjustments, and then he finishes his work. His concerns are more likely involving whether he gets the specs done on time, whether he'll get his bonus, whether he can make all of the meetings, those kinds of things, rather than artistic and symbolic types of considerations. Well, somebody designs the buildings. They must be concerned with loftier principles at some level, perhaps at the level of the church architects in the church office building. This isn't necessarily true either. Their concerns are also dictated to them. We are fast-growing and not a very wealthy church, so designs should be highly functional, practical. Churches should be built which are easy and inexpensive to operate and inexpensive to build. Translated, this means rectangular, standardized, replicative plans, chapels without windows, minimalization of windows, energy conservation, simple structures, simple systems, elevations, and materials, and a square foot, which is exactly prescribed to the foot for the size of the building. So architects, even at the highest level, in order to keep in favor, keep their jobs, are preoccupied with utilitarian concerns for the most part. You may say, well, we have a heritage plan now, which seems to be an improvement. You can now put two windows in the front of the building instead of none. And meeting houses now have classical or colonial ornament and steeples. Well, irrelevant, I say. Minor variations on a bad theme. Returning to pseudo-colonial anachronisms, as the church has done two other times, as Marty has shown, is still regression. Marty speaks of the value of architectural art and symbolism and the tension between form, content, and symbol. She proposes that, quote, Mormon steeples can legitimately be used as symbolic expression of the psychological condition of the modern-day church. Well, for better or for worse, I think this is true. Steeples must stand for something. After all, they're there, and someone designed them and built them and, more importantly, paid for them. They didn't appear accidentally. They were intended. But what exactly was intended? As Marty queries, steeples are, quote, a symbol of what? I think we can deal with symbols, steeples, on two levels. First, whether they exist at all. And secondly, if they do exist, what do they say by virtue of their design? Marty has shown that in the church's architectural history, we've had alternating periods of steeples and no steeples. The vernacular era didn't have any because, first, they were simple buildings. They couldn't afford them. And another point in addition to that is that the early Mormon meeting houses were coming out of the low church, non-liturgical, square, nave meeting house tradition as opposed to the high liturgical, fancier churches. And so for several reasons, the early churches had no steeples. Then we go into periods of Gothic revival, big steeples. We then go into prairie style, no steeples. Then into the neo-colonial, no steeples. Then Elizabethan Tudor Gothic in the 30s, big steeples. Then back to the modern and international in the 40s, 30s and 40s, no steeples, and so forth. There's sort of this cycle that goes through our history. So we've had buildings with steeples and without. What does this mean? I think it means that Mormons have always been aware that steeples signify, in Christianity, a church building, but they're not necessarily locked into that idea, since at least half the time they have not had steeples. I think it's more important to know that almost all Mormon architecture has been borrowed from existing or already lapsed stylistic movements. As borrowers of the decorative vocabularies of others, we have not been very particular about what we've appropriated. If the architectural, if Mormon architecture has a tradition, I think it is a tradition of borrowing. As borrowers, well, I'm going to skip over some details so we can get to some questions. Okay, let me pick it back up here. We're talking about the 50s, 60s, steeples, no steeples. The cyclical steepling was driven not by theological or architectural form-giving concerns conceived by the church, but solely by the styles the church indiscriminately borrowed. This is my opinion. I'm not sure Marty will agree. As cultural eclectics, and this is the second tradition of, this is the second half of Mormon architectural tradition, which is eclecticism. It is consistent that the church could have a take-it-or-leave-it view of steeples, as we have with styles in general. Given that the very existence of steeples is essentially an accident of style, it seems we cannot make too much of individual steeple design. Some unwritten 20th century dictum seems to call for steeples, so we've had them attached and unattached, even now, as Marty's indicated. In fact, both the Sages and the Codys now have options for roof-mounted steeples or yard steeples. I think the church's thinking is, no matter what the building looks like, read that to mean even if it doesn't look like a church. If it has a steeple, it is a church by definition, and that is a Christian church. Mormons need to make this point clear. Marty speaks of afterthought steeples. Other than trying to conform with a building style, which in some cases we saw, individual steeple design is often an afterthought. Some have no design relationship to the buildings they're associated with. Some are ordered from a catalog. Their specific design is often inconsequential. Their one intent, it seems to me at least, is to say steeple equals church. Given the otherwise secular character of LDS churches, steeples have become the most visible and most important symbol and definers of our churches. I believe this is a backward approach to good church design. 5 years ago in Logan, I designed a two-chapel, eight-ward meeting house for a student stake. I designed the exterior and the interior to look like a church. I called for no steeple, and the stake president agreed, so there was no steeple. I expect there to be one someday, but there's not one now, as far as I know. While the users of the building love it dearly, at least one church leader has criticized the design. Without the giveaway clue of a steeple, one can't immediately tell it's a church. And with the exterior looking like a real church, one can't tell it's a Mormon church. You get that? I designed a real church, and now some people are confused and uncomfortable in the absence of their familiar symbols or the corporate logo, as Marty, I think, very aptly put it. Current architects designing standard plans for the church are sensitive to criticism, like all ego-driven architects, I guess, are. I have heard them justify their plans with scripture and what I'll call arco-theology. The Sage, the Cody, the temples, these forms are intentionally tent-like to reflect the concept of the biblical tent and the stakes in Zion and logic of this sort. So now we have a new dilemma. For once, Mormons are creating an architectural tradition based on Mormon programs and needs instead of trying to fit Mormon feet in the Gentile shoes. That's a real plus. We're breaking out at last. The problem is the results are so displeasing, so aesthetically barren, and so unsuccessful. Again, this is my view. We were producing more awe-inspiring ecclesiastical architecture when we were building fine Gothic copies. So what do? The New Heritage Plan may be a step backward. We are an adolescent church. Let's stay the course. Let's keep the idea of creating forms, ornament, and symbols directly reflective of the best aspects of our own belief system. Our current buildings reflect our current beliefs, which I think is a sad commentary on the state of our beliefs, because I think if the architecture is mediocre, corporate, replicative, boring, flat, whatever, I think all of those things are direct comments on the people who created them. We need to elevate the quality of our beliefs, or at least the policies that reflect them, as well as produce a truly Mormon architecture of excellence. It has taken other religions hundreds of years to do this, but some of them have done it. I hope it will not take hundreds of years for Mormons to achieve this, but I see no evidence to the contrary. When it happens, you can be sure that a mature, fully Mormon architectural expression will announce a church-wide maturity in thinking behind the form. That's all I want to say.